What does it take to do the impossible? What does it take to level up your game like never before? What does it take for individuals, organizations, for even institutions to achieve paradigm shifting, nothing is ever the same again, breakthroughs?
Our mission is to decode the neurobiology of flow and cognitive peak performance. Access the minds of maverick scientists, groundbreaking innovators, and world-leading experts to understand what it takes to achieve ultimate human performance. So you can feel your best, perform your best, and accomplish your boldest goals. I'm your host, Rian Doris, and together with best-selling author Stephen Kotler, I present to you Flow Research Collective Radio. Hey there, folks. Welcome to the first episode of Flow Research Collective Radio. And our guest today is the one and only Mr. Stephen Kotler, the main man here at the Flow Research Collective. So really excited to jump into some of the fundamental questions about what the Flow Research Collective is, what we're trying to do with it, what flow is, why we believe it matters, and those kinds of things today. So first question, Stephen, is literally just a description of the Flow Research Collective. So can we kick off by hearing how you describe what the Flow Research Collective is?
I think of us as a research and training side, and I think they're very linked. On the training side, the goal has always been the same, which is, I guess this is a research and training goal, to decode the neurobiology of flow and use what we learn to create the best science-based peak performance training in the world.
Can you tell us more about what decoding the neurobiology of flow means?
It's something of a moving target is, I guess, the first thing. When I think of the neurobiology of flow, whenever you're talking about brain function or body function, you have to kind of pick a level of, hey, this is the level we're going to play at. And I think of it in terms of neural anatomy and networks. So those two things answer the question of where in the brain something is taking place. Neural anatomy describes very specific structures, the insula, the medial prefrontal cortex, and networks, because very few things take place in one spot in the brain. They tend to take place in these networks. And networks work one of two ways. They're either parts of the brain that are hardwired together, so there's kind of faster information flow between them, or they're parts of the brain that light up at the same time and they tend to do work together. The default mode network, the salience network, the fear network, those sorts of things. So that's half of the equation. The other half is neuroelectricity and neurochemistry, which are literally the two ways the brain communicates with itself and with the body. Well, also, there's also some neurophysiology, heart rate variability, those kinds of signals that will often also play a role. I don't tend to think about, so what's being excluded from this, for example, is we're not talking about field theory and interactions of whole electrical fields in the brain, though that's very cutting edge neuroscience. And at some point we might be, but up to now we are not. We are not talking about the molecular genetic level of flow. We have a little bit of information. There's a little bit of data that's a little bit of work been done, but that's not really the level we're playing at. And the reason we play at the level we talked about is simply that I find it to be the most practical level, right? We study the neurobiology because neurobiology gives you mechanism. If you look at flow trainings in the 1990s, when they were really just building their trainings on top of the psychology of flow, the success rate at training flow was very low. People were very spotty at it. It went up and down. It's because the psychology was very squishy. But over the past 20 years, we figured out the neurobiology, the mechanism, and that has made training flow significantly easier and more reliable, more repeatable. And the mechanism that is most important to me is stuff that is practical. Where can I make a practical real-world intervention? And one final comment, the collective, and there's a lot we could talk about why this is, but I like to focus on, and we try to focus on, psychological neurobiological interventions. We don't spend a lot of time on technological interventions, this technology that can drive you into flow. And we might get there at some point. I don't think the technology is there yet. And I don't think it's a good idea to rely on technological crutches. And we don't spend a lot of time on substances, right? There's a lot of interesting work on psychedelics and all meditation and all that stuff. We don't tend to spend a lot of time there. We tend to look for the psychological and neurobiological interventions mostly because in crisis situations, I don't think you want to have to rely on a substance or a technology to drive you in a state of peak performance. I think you want to be able to tap into this stuff at will when you need it. And that means psychological, neurobiological interventions. And I like to start with the neurobiology because it's less squishy and you get better results. And if you look at networks, neural anatomy, neural electricity, and neural chemistry, it's practical. That level of scrutiny or level of whatever that is, scale, that level of scale seems to give us kind of the best tools for the job. So that's how I think about it. But again, as we learn more and more and more about the brain, right? 10 years ago, if you had asked me this question, I would have never even mentioned networks because we just didn't really think about things in those terms just yet. Maybe 15 years ago.
Is it a fair summation in simple speak to say that we are trying to understand what's happening in the brain when people are in flow because it will allow us to train it more effectively?
Yeah, I think we're trying to understand what's happening in the brain when people are in performing at their best. Mm-hmm. Most of the time that includes flow, but there are certainly times you can perform at your best out of flow. I just think we're interested across the boards. And as you know, if you really look under the hood of peak performance, you tend to see kind of four classes of skills, motivation skills, and that includes intrinsic drives, grit, perseverance skills, and goals. You see all kinds of accelerated learning, learning and accelerated learning. And then you see creativity, right? Ways to sort of think differently. And then you see flow. So those four components tend to, when we talk about cognitive peak performance, which is what we focus on primarily, you talk about motivation, learning, creativity, and flow, and you need all those things. Motivation, learning, creativity are all amplified by flow, but if I train you up in flow and teach you to produce more flow in your life and you don't have a really good foundation, motivation, learning, and flow, you have problems. And the stupid metaphor is a car going 10 miles an hour. If it hits a tree, you dent the fender. But a car going 100 miles an hour, it hits that same tree. Now you've got a really serious problem. Flow is 100 miles an hour. So you need the skill sets that flow amplifies to be very solid in your system. Otherwise, you can't amplify them successfully over time.
Interesting. Now, that's a helpful distinction, I think, between peak performance and flow, because we use those words a lot, but I think it's helpful to clarify that they're not synonymous. Peak performance is the umbrella overarching category, and flow is one of the main subcomponents. So just to backtrack a little bit, I think one of the ideas that's very central to us is very interesting to folks, which is the idea that you can train something that is not just a skill, but that is actually a state of consciousness. Can you talk a little bit about how you see training a state of consciousness like flow as different from training up a skill, like, for example, time management?
It's a hard question to answer simply. So historically, we, meaning humans, did train up states of consciousness. It's only been since the Enlightenment when we started to privilege kind of rational thought, this kind of, you know, one state of consciousness as predominant, that we sort of lost this ability. And, you know, one of the points made in Stealing Fire is a great many of the so-called skills we want in the 20th century, creativity, learning, flow, these sorts of things, they're not skills. They're states of consciousness. To be creative, the brain changes. All a state is a global change in brain function, right? It's a global change in the brain. A skill may be isolated in one specific thing. You're talking about a global change in brain function. So we are not used to training it because we haven't done it, right? Most of the skills that we train up these days are much different, but we know how to do it. We've done it historically. And, you know, if you go into, you know, all the wisdom traditions, when they're using things like mindfulness practices or different forms of prayer and meditation and things like that, those are state-changing technologies. So it's not that there isn't, you know, long history here. It's that we've gotten away from it for 300 years, but we're coming back to it kind of across the boards because we're starting to understand that the so-called skills we need are actually accessible through states, right? Mm. Cooperation and collaboration and communication, these are skills that people talk about, but they're really state shifts. And if you think about, like, when you go out to dinner with your friends and you're just talking versus when the conversation gets really good and you sort of lock in and start to get lost in it, and right, what happens? It's a shift. Everything inside you changes. It's not just that you're focusing more on what your friend is saying. It's the emotions of it, engagement, all these different things. It's been a global shift. So you're shifting state to improve collaboration, communication, cooperation. We just don't think of it that way.
I think that's super helpful, the distinction between state and skill. And one of the ways that I've heard you describe it or write about it before is that training a state is just a more systemic intervention. You get the state right, and then a wide variety of more specific skills are going to be amplified as a result of that.
That's exactly correct. That's just, yes. Yes, what Rian said.
We got there. For example, anyone is going to be better at coding or writing or speaking when in flow.
Yes, of course. Yeah, of course. And some of this is, right, flow is what happens, among other things, anything you do, conducting an interview for a podcast. There are 20 or 30 sub skills that go into conducting a good interview. There is a whole research process that is underneath it. There is how do you speak? There's understanding the technology. How do you edit? These are all skill sets, right, themselves. But you have to learn them all independently. Flow is sort of what happens when you take all this stuff that you've learned independently and then the brain can use it together all at once. It's a bunch of skills that come up together at once and are all sort of being automatized. You've trained up the individual skills to the level that you can now do them at an unconscious level, and they all sort of come together at once in a higher level. So flow amplifies everything kind of just by design.
Right. That makes total sense. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why training states and flow specifically is becoming increasingly important as technology accelerates, because the diversity of specific skills we need to be able to be good at is constantly expanding. And so by getting the kind of fundamental underlying piece right, the ability to drive yourself into the right state.
Yeah, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. I don't care what it is that you're trying to learn. If I jack up your motivation and productivity, if I jack up your creative problem-solving skills, and I amplify learning, meaning literally I make it easier for you to take information in from short-term memory and store it long-term, right? Those are all the things flow brings, among others. Those are the things that flow bring. Everything you're going to be doing therein will be amplified.
Right. No, that makes total sense.
And it's the most important thing is this. The human brain evolved to perform in peak states, right? Flow is universal. It shows up in anyone and anywhere, provided certain initial conditions are met, because this is simply how evolution shaped humans to perform at their best. You need peak performance. Flow was how we developed that skill. It doesn't matter what you're doing inside the thing, right? The brain is very conservative by design. So does it want to optimize? Well, you're going to have to fight over here to survive. You're going to have to hunt and gather for resources, or you're going to have to know how to hunt and gather for resources once the seasons change and the game disappears. Or right, there's a lot of different things you're going to need to know how to do. So you can, those are all individual skills. You can get better at them over time, but evolution shaped a state change that increases productivity, learning, creativity, et cetera, to amplify it across the boards. It's kind of a global tool, right?
Yeah, exactly. Global tool is a nice way to put it. So one of the amazing things I think that you've done is popularize flow and then use action and adventure sports athletes as a case study for flow in a certain sense. Can you talk a little bit about, firstly, why action and adventure sports athletes make such a great case study for flow, and then how we can reproduce those same states outside of those activities? Yeah.
So I think I sort of did flow a great service by writing Rise and talking about action adventure sport athletes, and at the same time I did people a great disservice. And the service was, I chose action adventure sport athletes for a very simple reason, which is, how do you know? We don't have a biophysical based flow detector at the Flow Research Collective. On the, you know, we have a research agenda, and the next stop, what are we doing? What are we researching? What the first thing we're trying to do is build a biophysical based flow detector, something that can measure biological, neurological, and physiological signals and say, hey, you're in flow. Right now, we have psychological questionnaires, and they're squishy and they're subjective, and they're extremely well validated and we really like them and we use them and they're ubiquitous in the field. But if you want to know for absolute certain, is somebody in flow? Action adventure sport athletes are a great example because the level of performance has gone up so high that at the upper level, it's almost impossible to do what these people are doing if they're not in flow. So it gave me a very hard data set. I could trust that my research subjects were in flow if they survived. You know, in Rise of Superman, I said, you know, at the upper level, you know, if you're skiing in Alaska and you're a professional skier and you're doing big mountain skiing with a helicopter rise kind of thing, if you're not in flow at the top, you know, by the time you're at the bottom, chances are you're going to the hospital, right? Chances are you're not going to be able to pull it off. So it was a great starting point. The other thing is it's visible to the naked eye, right? Up till 1996, the biggest wave anybody had ever surfed was 25 feet. And from 1996, like this is a 1,000-year-old sport. For 1,000 years, the best we can do is 25 feet. And then in 20 years, we go up to waves that are 100 feet tall. Everybody can see the difference in size, right? It's clearly visible. It's a very good example. Also, action sport athletes were reliably getting into flow more than everybody else. There's some really good work that was done at Cal State Fullerton by a guy named Ken Raziza, who was looking at, even though flow is really associated with athletics all the time, he was looking at bat and ball and track and field sports, and he found that flow is sort of like a highlight experience in athletes' careers. It's not an everyday experience. And for action adventure sport athletes, it was an everyday experience. I think it's an everyday experience for artists, for coders, for, you know, like Mick Csikszentmihalyi learned years ago that we spend 5% of our work life in flow, often without noticing it. And the most common experience of flow on the planet appears to be middle managers in conversation at work, lost in group flow, right? This is when you and I start talking about how's our training doing, or is there something we could, and you know, we're supposed to talk for 10 minutes and we talk for 2 hours, right? We don't even notice what happened. That's the most common flow state on the planet. It's just two people at work in conversation, losing track of time, maybe your sense of self doesn't vanish completely. So it's not fancy. You don't feel like, God, I wasn't one with everything. My self just disappeared. But you don't notice the fact that like 2 hours later, when I pop back into my head, I'm like, oh my God, I got to go to the bathroom. I got to pee really badly. That was your sense of self disappearing. You just lost your bodily functions, right? Like you lost bodily awareness. You pop back in, you're like, oh my God, I got to pee. You don't notice what happened. But like those stuff are really common. Probably as common as action adventure sport athletes getting into flow. But I'm not going to kind of be able to like tell the world that they're capable of huge feats of peak performance by talking about middle managers at work forgetting they had to go to the bathroom, right? It's just not super sexy. And also, you know, that was my origin story. Everybody know, the Lyme disease is a story people that really like to tell, but like I had been running around with these action professional athletes since I started my journalism career. I was 23 years old. And I was, I think, 24, 25, the first time I was on a mountain with professional athletes before. And the very first time, I had been skiing since I was 4 years old. I thought I was excellent at it. And the first time I got onto a mountain with professional athletes, it was like through the looking glass. It was the strangest acid trip I've ever had in my entire life. I was like, it was literally like watching people break the laws of physics right in front of me. And it didn't, on top of the fact that they were doing it, like these were the same people I was getting drunk with at night in the bars. And they were like very clearly human beings with fucked up relationships and horrific pasts and no money. And they were working as a dishwasher and a caddy and every, you know, and just to pay the bills and blah, blah, blah. And yet here they were going out on the mountains in between doing things that defied the laws of physics. And I was watching it, you know, firsthand. So it was so much of my kind of sense of wonder and admiration for what flow makes possible was rooted in action sport athletes. And I always tell people, when you're writing, sort of always try to like figure out how did I learn something? Because if you figured out how you learn something, you figure out what, and you, it's always, there's an order, a sequence. I learn this first, I learn this second, I learn this third. I sort of figure I'm not that special. If I can learn it, anybody can learn it. Just what's the order? And usually that order starts with, oh my God, I saw something amazing and I needed to understand it, or I saw something horrific and I needed to understand it. That sort of experience. My first 10 experience was seeing the action adventure sport athletes, you know, do things where I would just, it was beyond comprehension. I'm going to tell you stories that might give these examples, but it didn't even make any sense to me. So I figured if I was that lit up and fired up about it, that would get conveyed in the writing. So some of it was just good storytelling and good energy and excitement that I used. I used them. I also knew the space really, really well. And so I could talk about stuff at a very technical level, and it was an easier example. So there was a lot of different, there was some art concerns. There were some good case study concerns. I thought it was a good way to communicate this information. I thought everybody could see it.
Reading Rise of Superman is a bizarre experience in that it drives you into flow like no other book while you're reading about it, but it's not necessarily just the stories, it's the nature of the writing. So if anyone has not read it, it's definitely a must. But I wanted to backtrack a little bit to the scientific emphasis and approach we have and ask you simply why we actually value science and try and take, you know, an evidence-based or neuroscientifically backed approach to peak performance. Can you talk a little bit about why science is useful versus
There's just two things that are worth talking about here. There's a ton more, but the two things I focus on is this. The first, okay, I lied. Three things. Thing one, whenever you say peak performance, the evidence is really overwhelming. All you're ever talking about is getting our biology to work for us rather than against us. Right, that's all we can mean. There's no such thing as a hack. There's no shortcuts. There's just our biology. You're either working with your biology or you're working against your biology. And this is not a new idea. I always say that, you know, 100 years ago in the very first psychological textbook ever written, William James, kind of godfather of psychology, one of the first people who really wrote extensively about peak performance, he said, look, the most important thing in any education is to make your nervous system your ally instead of your enemy, right? He's saying befriend your brain. That's all that peak performance is. The second thing, that the second reason we focus so much on the science is the major error in coaching, in training, in peak performance, this whole field is routinely what happens is somebody figures out what works for them and they try to teach it to other people. And it fails miserably most of the time. And the reason is certain sort of basic foundational components in peak performance are shaped by genetics and shaped by early childhood environments. So where you are in the introversion to extroversion scale, your risk tolerance is where you, like where you lie, huge impact on how you should approach peak performance. What works for me is guaranteed not to work for you. I always tell people, if what worked for me worked for you, we'd all be skiing through the trees at 50 miles an hour, listening to hip hop at top volume, often stoned out of your mind. Because that really works well for me, right? And do I want to go into Google and say, hey guys, we're going to smoke fatties and go tree skiing and listen to some Public Enemy? Of course it's not going to work for everybody, right? I mean, that's just common sense. And yet you see this over and over and over and over again. And they gussy it up and they disguise it with like psychological language and kind of our new age spirituality or blah, blah, blah. But it's really, this is what worked for me. And so I want to teach it to you. And the intentions are great, but it literally, we focus on the science because evolution shaped us all to perform at our best. So it used a certain skill set. I've got two more answers to this question. I'm going to give you the short one first, and then I'll come back to what I'm saying right now and give you a longer, fuller answer about that. The short answer is also, science is a common language. It is a evidence-based system, so you can trust the information. more than you can trust other things, personal opinion, anecdotal evidence. So you, there's more confidence in it. And I'm confident in the data, meaning I think if it works for me, it's going to work for you, right? Because it's biological based data. It's broader. And it gives us a shared language. Great advancements in this field over the past 100 years have really come from partnerships between folks on the spiritual side and folks on the scientific side, because there's wisdom traditions that have learned a great deal, the Buddhist tradition about peak performance over the years, but it's very hard to access that stuff because it's written in languages, first of all, not in English, right? So if you speak English or, you know, don't speak the original languages, a lot of this stuff was written in, you're at a disadvantage. You're working through translations, first of all, written in other centuries, totally different languages, and meaning like terminology. What's the common denominator? When these partnerships have been to fruition, oftentimes the people on the spiritual side, the Dalai Lama, when he worked with Richie Davidson, the University of Wisconsin, it was because the Dalai Lama started reading neuroscience and started realizing the stuff that they were doing with meditation had correlates in neuroscience, and he brought it to Richie Davidson. And there was this shared common language, right? Richie Davidson was a guy living in Madison, Wisconsin. The Dalai Lama lived in Tibet. They're very different lives, different backgrounds, different personalities, different everything. But they could share, they had a common language in science. So that it allows you to bridge gaps between a lot of different knowledge bases. And that's really important. It's a shared language. It's not weighed down by culture or history. More importantly, or sort of the final thing I guess I wanted to say, is when you look at the stuff that Flow amplifies, it seems like a really peculiar assortment, right? Here's a single state of consciousness that on the physical side of the equation deadens pain, increases strength, increases stamina, increases persistence, increases fast twitch muscle response. And then on the cognitive side of the equation, it amplifies motivation, productivity, 500% according to kind of the McKinsey study on top executives. Creativity and innovation, depending on whose numbers you look at, 230 to 740%. You see learning rates accelerated 240 to 500%. Then you get cooperation, collaboration, and then you see meaning and purpose and all these sort of like quality of life metrics. What the hell? Why would one state amplify this such a weird assortment of things? Empathy, ecological awareness also go up. Where the hell is this coming from? Well, it turns out evolution is the answer. Natural selection is the largest driver of evolution. Scarcity of resources is the largest driver of natural selection. So when you talk about peak performance, you are really talking about a state created by evolution to handle scarce resources. And when resources are scarce, there are two options. You can fight, right, over scarce dwindling resources, or you can flee to kind of avoid becoming somebody else's resources, or you can get creative, get innovative, and get cooperative and make new resources. So what gets amplified by Flow? Everything you need to either fight or flee, or create, innovate, and make new resources. That's the package. That's why you asked this question earlier about state change. Why does it amplify all? Because it's a big, like evolution was trying to solve the problem of resource scarcity with a state of peak performance, right? That was the equation. So that's why you see it having such a big impact across the boards. And I also think that's why you want a science-based approach. Because if you go piecemeal, if you go, okay, I'm going to work on task management this week, and next week I'm going to work on blah, 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 you're missing sort of the big picture and the big lever.
Makes total sense. Yeah, you're leveraging the entirety of evolution if you work downstream from the biology. Makes total sense. So I want to backtrack a little bit with you personally. We got two questions on that front. One is about West Jesus is a book that a lot less people, I think, have read, at least, especially in more recent years. But I want to ask you about how you ended up getting to writing West of Jesus. And then the question afterwards, which I'll touch back on so you don't remember it, is just about the mentors that you've had, going all the way from the mentors through books like Maslow down to more direct mentors. some of whom I know were involved a little bit around the influence of West of Jesus.
Well, this was the book I kind of wrote about my experience with Lyme disease. And it was, you have to remember at the time I started writing West and researching West, it was 2001 or 2002. When I started looking at flow, I didn't know it was called flow. And right away, and so I started out looking at the neuroscience of mystical experiences because I was having these altered state experiences. Time was slowing down, right? Like performance was going through, they felt mystical, blah, blah, this is an uncommon flow, of course. And we know this, but that's where I started. And the first place I went, I sort of got lucky. I was trying to figure out why the hell surfing had cured my Lyme disease and why I was producing these profound mystical experiences. And it was the mystical experiences I was more focused on because I thought the Lyme had gotten into my brain and I was having these experiences because I was dying, right? The disease was killing me very quickly. And I wanted to figure out what the hell was going on with me. So that's where I focused. And I got inordinately lucky in that Dr. Andrew Newberg, who was then at the University of Pennsylvania, who's sort of the godfather of the field now known as neurotheology, the application of the tools of neurobiology to this study of so-called spiritual and mystical experiences, had just done his first set of imaging studies on Tibetan Buddhists and Franciscan nuns who had experienced oneness with everything, right? They meditated, they would feel one with everything. I was talking to surfers who, we're talking about surfing, not like a sport like, hey, I have got this hobby, it's called surfing, I really like it, and I knit a little crochet on the weekends, and you know what I mean? Like, it was a religion, and they would believe in surfing sort of the way my parents believed in Judaism, or you know what I mean? And or they're and I was like, why do people believe in things? All those kinds of questions were swirling around. That's where West of Jesus came from. And when I called Dr. Newberg, surfers had been telling me that they kept feeling one with the ocean. I so remember my first meeting with Laird Hamilton. And Laird was talking about, like, you go there and it's always the same and you become one with everything. You become one with the ocean. All these things. And I was thinking to myself, is he out of his mind? Is this guy crazy? Right? And yet, over and over, I kept hearing these stories, and that was the same. Newberg was the same thing. He was like, God, this question of oneness, it shows up in every religion in the world long before there was mass communication. So either it's the largest hallucination in history, like mass hallucination in history, that persists through time, or there's biology there. I just saw the same thing in surfers, and so I called Andrew, and I was like, do you think the same amount of focus you need to meditate is the same focus that you need to ride a wave? And could this be the same altered state of consciousness, and how does it work? That was the first question to this guy who I never met. And it turns out that Dr. Andrew Newberg is maybe one of the nicest people on the face of the earth. And literally, he just took me under his wing. He became wasn't my first mentor, but he was one of my early mentors and was incredibly patient with me and incredibly supportive. And, you know, we spent months and months and months and months. I would, you know, I'd call him up, I'd ask him a bunch of questions, and then I'd go away wander into the realms of neuroscience research for 4 months and come back and talk to him for like three more. And I just kept doing this until we started piecing it together. You know, I think that's influenced the work ever since.
Hey there, it's Rian, interrupting the episode for a second. We are trying to get Flow Research Collective Radio out into the world as much as possible so more people can learn about flow and peak performance, especially during these uncertain times. If you want to help us out with that, one crazy simple thing you could do is pull out your phone and hit the subscribe button on your podcast player. This will get you notified when we come out with new episodes, and it will also do all sorts of cool things to the podcast player's algorithm to get Flow Research Collective Radio out to more people. So we'd really appreciate it if you pop your phone out for a sec and hit subscribe. Now back to the show. So I think it's interesting for folks, especially going from having mentioned and emphasized the scientific emphasis back to West of Jesus and that origin story.
Well, the other thing Rin, you have to understand, I never tell this part of the origin story. I mean, it's there in Rise of Super, or it's there in the street, but like, I dropped out of college and moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, because the New Age was happening and they weren't teaching me anything in college. I was interested in all the spiritual woo side of the coin, everything. I spent years hanging out in monasteries, going, you know, sitting Zazen with monks, and I could sit in the full lotus for 6, 7, 8 hours at a time. I could meditate. I did every psychedelic known to man. I was looking for these mystical experiences as people kept talking about, and nothing mystical ever happened, right? Like, my friends would take psychedelics and they would see God, and I was just like a little hornier than I normally was. Right. I mean, like, it didn't make any sense to me. Like, I don't know what was going on. And then, so I start surfing and start having these crazy mystical experiences. I had already like gone all the way down that rabbit hole, and I came back on the other side and I never found anything mystical. It didn't work for me for whatever reason. And now there's some neurobiology underneath it, and I understand sort of why it didn't work a little bit, but that's a totally different story. But I tried all of it. And I found it useless. I'm not saying it's useless for other people, but at the time, it did not get me A to B at all. And flow got me to A to B very, very quickly, with a lot less drama, a lot less nonsense.
I love that kind of full circle story. It's exactly what I was going to ask. So that was exactly spot on. But so mentors, whenever I think of you and the word mentors, I think of the likes of William James, Maslow, Csikszentmihalyi. Can you give us a little breakdown of who your biggest mentors have been, maybe directly, like Dr. Andrew Newberg, and then intellectually, like Nietzsche, James, Maslow?
My mentors, there's a guy named Joe Loeffler, who was my first, he was a professional magician. I was a magician when I was a kid. I did birthday parties and bar mitzvahs and weddings and all that stuff. And Joe owned the magic store where I grew up. And so he was probably my first mentor and taught me a great many sort of peak performance basics I learned from Joe. So it always starts there. For John Barth, who I studied under in graduate school, was another great mentor of mine. Andrew Newberg was another great mentor of mine. Patricia Wright, who is a MacArthur Genius Award winning primatologist. She studies lemurs in Madagascar. So there's a whole another side of my world that involves kind of work with animals and a lot of work with flow around that work too. But Pat was one of my great mentors. I worked with her in Madagascar, in Ramanafana National Park, kind of studying lemurs. And my photographer, who I brought with me, I was a journalist, ended up meeting Pat's daughter, who was then in her early 20s. And they've been now married for 15 years, but they met. And so Pat kind of came into my life through this story. And I spent a lot of time with her in Madagascar, but has been in my life ever since. And I always say, like, if you want to understand grit, there's a whole troop of female, they're all women, and they're all wildlife biologists or primatologists. They study animals in nature, and they are, without a doubt, the toughest people on earth, working in the harshest conditions, in environments where it's often incredibly unsafe for women to be in general and yet alone. I mean, just like, they are paragons of peak performance against Herculean odds, besides everything else that they do. So Pat Wright was a great mentor of mine. There's a wildlife vet named Kathleen Ramsey. She lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico. She was another one of these mentors of mine. And then book-wise, you know, there's a huge intellectual history. William James, obviously Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Mike's a brilliant thinker, not just on flow. I think he's one of the greatest creativity researchers. I think he's one of the best philosophical thinkers on consciousness over the past 100 years. He's sort of that line, because I do know him a little bit, but not well enough to call him that mentor. But certainly, you know, his books have been hugely impactful. Maslow, of course, William James, of course, Friedrich Nietzsche, of course. These are the lineage of peak performance thinkers. These are people who have thought really, really long and hard about kind of the neurobiology of peak performance. These days, I've been lucky enough, and I'm old enough at this point, that I've gotten to kind of work with and get to know a great many of the other people who might kind of slide into that position. Not exactly mentors. I just Anders Ericsson died today. Not a mentor, not even a friend, but a guy who was wonderful and I'd met and could call up and ask a flow question every now and again. And, you know, he never bullshitted you. He always gave you Tim Ferriss says that it's great to surround yourself with people who force you to ask the better question or they ask the better question, right? He was sort of like that. So it's, you know, the mentors, it's a lot of people have sort of shaped my thinking, mostly because I think the world of peak performance is often populated by really great people. The men and women kind of working on this stuff tend to be very kind-hearted, for whatever reason, I've been very lucky. So there's a lot of people who have usually influenced me are in this world now. I don't know super well, but they've been incredibly generous sort of when I've put myself in their life and asking questions like a two-year-old.
Yeah, Ericsson, amazing contributor to the field. Next place I want to go is to having a passion, having a purpose, and keeping it to your damn self, and actually breaking that rule just a tiny bit, because I want to ask you about your MTPs. And just for context for everyone, the phrase MTP refers to massively transformative purpose. It's the idea of having this kind of infinite North Star that your whole life and work is pointed or directed at. And I know you've got three MTPs, Stephen, mainly. You mind breaking them down for folks?
Let's start by demystifying passion and purpose, because yes, I've got a passion and purpose, and that sounds like, you know, capital P. And seriously, man, like, people fetishize the hell out of these terms. Passion and purpose, these are flow triggers, right? You want more flow in your life, have a passion and purpose. Why? We pay more attention to those things we believe in, and flow follows focus. It's that simple. Passion and purpose are intrinsic motivators. They produce dopamine. Dopamine drives focus. Get more flow. I have three. And by the way, I have actually a way that I word these things in my head, and I have never once said it out loud, nor will I ever say it out loud. Like, they're mine, but I try to write books that will have a pretty significant impact in the world. That's the first thing I try to do. The second thing I try to do is advance flow science and research. And the third thing I do is try to make the world a better place for animals. Those are my three North Stars. And again, they sound like passion, purpose with a capital P, but really what they are filters. If a thing comes to me, right, and it does not, I always say I do six things in this life, right? I have my three MTPs. And then I've got, you know, friends and family, hurling myself down mountains at high speed, and all the support shit I have to do to take care of my three MTPs, like podcasts with Riam. Right? I mean, that's what it is. So I do like, no, they're equal rungs. You know what I mean? Like, I don't prioritize. I do six things in this world, right? You know, I have my three MTPs. And to make those possible, well, I have to have kind of friends and family. Like, for social support reasons, just for peak performance alone, I need to have friends and family, and also for quality of life, right? And then I also have to do all the support stuff, the business stuff it takes to go after those MTPs. And then I have to hurl myself down mountains at high speeds on a regular basis because, you know, skiing, mountain biking, surfing, that's not quite a mountain, but it's a mountain of water, so we'll deal with it. It's a metaphor, folks. That's the stuff I have to do to keep my head right so I can go after the MTPs, right? If it's not those six things, it's a no. It's just a no. I don't, like, why bother? You know what I mean? Like, that's just sort of how I am with it. I think of it as a filter for my life. And, you know, you're never going to have those. It's not going to be that crystal clear in your 20s. It shouldn't be. You should take a while to get to something that is that rigid a filter for your life, right? Because there's a narrowing that happens, and you don't want to close off all those options. So, you know, I think this is also people who are in their teens or their 20s, and they don't know what their passion and purpose is. Certainly, you know, in Art of Impossible and The Passion Recipe, there are ways to discover what is your passion and purpose, right? There's biology underneath this stuff. You can use it. It's not nearly as hard or as mystical as anybody believes. But I would not be in a rush to get there, right? I would just like slow down a little bit. You know, David Epstein, great, great thinker, and, you know, his book Range, I think, is just one of the most foundational books in peak performance, talks about the need for wide sampling periods for peak performance. You've got to test everything out before you kind of figure that stuff out. You're better off that way.
It is absolutely one of the most effective ways. That's how I described it, is testing different lanes and then scratching them off. And eventually you're only left with a few lanes. And there's a good chance that those remaining lanes are good ones to stick with. So while we're on the slightly soppy topic of passion and purpose, I want to ask you about what sort of a positive dent you hope we leave, or at least the kind of positive dent we're trying to leave or make with the Flow Research Collective. And
I'm just going to give you a really ridiculously funny truthful answer on this one, I guess. So I always tell people, if you're interested in like my altruistic side or whatever, I don't much love people. I like people who came to really throw down and really go after the possible. I like those people the most. And I also like, I like the leading 10% who are really going for it. And I like the trailing 10%, the people who've gotten their fucking ass kicked so much, right? Those are really my people. I've been in parts of both groups at different times in my life. And sort of like, that feels like home to me, right? So even if I like people, that would be where I play. But I don't even like people. So I like, my interest is making the world a better place for animals. When I started Flow Research, nobody likes to say this out loud because everything these days has to be about a passion and purpose. Man, I am in it for the intellectual puzzle. Flow is the greatest mystery I've ever encountered, and I am in it for the freaking puzzle. I want more flow for me because it's a good drug. I want more flow for my friends because they seem to do good shit with it. But I've also spent a great deal of my life kind of steering around my own sort of selfishness, meaning like, I knew a long time ago that if I wanted to actually pay the bills, I was going to have to sort of get thought leader-y, publicly famous as a writer, just so I could keep writing books and pay the bills, right? Like, it was kind of required as built in the job. I also knew, because I grew up in communities where a lot of people were artists and athletes and whatever and got famous, fame wrecked people. It turned people into the biggest assholes in the world. So I always like, one of the reasons I started a dog sanctuary with my wife is it forces me to start every day because I clean up dog shit first thing in the morning every day of my life. It is humbling by design, right? Like, it's really hard to get like usually arrogant when you start every day of your life cleaning up dog shit, right? I steer around myself a lot. And what I mean by that is with flow, I wrote a book called Abundance, and Abundance is simply about the idea that right now in the world, we have the technology to solve our grandest global challenges: poverty, energy scarcity, water shortages, biodiversity crisis, those sorts of things. It doesn't happen automatically, but the technology is there. And Peter and I have always said, if we're going to pull this off to reach this world of abundance, it's going to take the largest cooperative effort in history. And it doesn't just mean everybody working together like never before, as if that wasn't hard enough. It means everybody performing at their absolute best. That means flow, working together, right? So it's people in flow utilizing cutting-edge disruptive technology to solve global grand challenges. The global grand challenge I care about personally as a selfish bastard is biodiversity. I like animals more than people. I care about, you know, I always say that my motto is empathy for all. And by empathy for all, I mean, yes, of course, obviously all people, but also plants, animals, and ecosystems, the ultimate underdog. That's what is interesting to me. That's what I'm fighting for here. And yes, flow is a backdoor here, folks, because it increases ecological awareness and empathy. So really, I'm training you up in flow, because once you're in flow, you're going to care more about the natural environment. And that's selfishly what I want. But I also think that if I'm going to do the greatest good I could possibly do on this planet, which, mind you, I'm not personally interested in doing, but it seems like a good thing, I'm going to teach as many people as possible to get into flow and let them utilize it and work with me to bring about this world of abundance. And so again, my interest is in the intellectual puzzle and flow and making the world a better place for animals. But I do know that the best thing I could do for the world is train up as many people as possible in flow, because that's the fastest way to go A to B to this world of abundance. So I do, right? I sort of guard around myself. I know where I have selfish asshole tendencies, and I just sort of build structures around my life to protect me from me. And the Flow Research Collective is one of those structures on a certain level.
Oh, love it. That's great. We pretty much accomplished what I was hoping to accomplish, which is to make sure that we kick off Flow Research Collective Radio with everyone getting to know you a little better. Anything else you want to touch on before we wrap about Flow Research Collective?
Yeah, I got a book coming out next January called The Art of Impossible, as you know. And mostly, right, it's essentially 30 years in peak performance. What have I learned? It's motivation, it's learning, it's creativity, and of course it's flow. But to write it, you know, when you write a book like that, you got to summarize a lot of, like, you got to summarize 20 years in like a sentence or two. And so it forced me to do a lot of thinking that way. And I think the overarching lesson of 30 years of studying the impossible, those moments in time when the impossible, right, this is never going to be done, it's never going to happen, became possible. Whether you're talking about the 4-minute mile or the invention of the internet, or you know what I mean? Doesn't matter where you are, or a huge kind of creative movement, grunge rock, or, you know, trance, or, you know, take your pick, any of those great creative breakthroughs. That's been my fascination. And I think the overwhelming lesson over and over and over again is that we are all capable of so much more than we know. We are literally, almost by design, oddly, incapable of seeing what's possible for us. To put this in different terms, if you speak the terms of complexity science at all, it's like human capability is an emergent property, right? And it only emerges by pushing on our skills and our states to the edge. You got to push yourself to the edge of your comfort zone, and you get to see a new possibility there. And there's this great term, the adjacent possible, right? The adjacent possible is, so when you walk into a room, there's 5 doors in that room, right? The room is what's possible. Behind each one of those 5 doors, that's the adjacent possible. It's where you could go next. It's where it leads. And you can only see it once you get into the first room, right? That's how capability works, right? Sort of the joke about learning is you're bad until you're better. It's why learning is so hard. It's fucking invisible. Whole process is invisible. You're bad and then you're not, right? It feels terrible and then it feels a little less terrible and suddenly like you can do this thing and it doesn't feel terrible at all and you don't even remember that it used to feel terrible. Capability is always that way. So we are all capable of so much more than you know. What's interesting about flow is flow seems to be the fastest way, and it's got its downsides and dangers, right? You don't want to do this willy-nilly, I guess, but it's the fastest way to kind of start to get a sense of what you're capable of. Flow, obviously, flow over time will get you to, you know, your ultimate capacity, but it's an emergent, like, hey, peel this layer of the onion back. Holy crap, I did that. Oh, peel that there. Holy crap, I did that, right? So I think if I want to leave people with anything, any idea, kind of, I think that's really sort of at the heart of the mission of the Flow Research Collective is, you know, we want to use the actual science of neurobiology to help, you know, each of us sort of peel back that onion of emergent capability and sort of unlock that impossible slaying capacity within all of us.
Super. Well, listen, thanks everyone for tuning in and listening. We're going to have lots more coming this
way.
Yeah,
by the way, folks, I hope this was useful. We wanted to do it as a kickoff, both because this is the kickoff of Flow Research Collective Radio, and we wanted to give you guys a kind of a foundation for who we are, where we went, and we hope it wasn't too obnoxious or self-serving along the way. So apologies for the obnoxious self-servingness of a first podcast about who we are and sort of where we come from and how we think about things, and the fact that I just talked about myself one way or another for an hour and a half. So apologies for all that.
All righty. Thanks, folks. All the best.
All the best.
If what you've heard on Flow Research Collective Radio has been helpful, please consider doing us a solid and leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are listening to this. Reviews help us connect to a wider audience so we can get these peak performance principles out to more people.